This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the fallout continues since the Supreme Court vote upholding the Affordable Care Act.
And no surprise, Mark, those battle lines continue to be drawn pretty squarely along party lines.
Well, Republicans in the House have launched their latest attempt, and I think it's number 31, to either overturn the law completely or to make some amendments to it.
Well, given the numbers in the Senate, that bill is likely to meet the same fate as the previous 30, but I doubt it will be the last, Mark. And some governors continue to hold out as well.
I think there are now seven GOP governors who are refusing to sign the health care Medicaid expansion provisions, which the high court left to the discretion of states to comply with, and maybe around 15 states in total that are still in play of whether or not they will participate in that expansion program.
And Texas Governor Rick Perry, who we heard a lot from over the last year when he was running for the Republican nomination, are among those vowing that he will not comply with the expansion of Medicaid, who would cover more of the uninsured who live close to the poverty line in his state. That means he's going to refuse federal dollars that would have come into his state to help support that expansion.
Governor Perry is still in campaign mode and behaving true to form. It's important to look back here at history, though. When Medicaid was first passed in the 1960s, only a handful of states signed up for the program initially.
You know, that's a really interesting point, Mark. It does take a while for these things to get fully rooted. The same is true for the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and even today doesn't get full participation, even though it reimburses states 65% of their costs for providing insurance for children.
Well, suffice to say, Margaret, the wheels of change are turning in the arena of healthcare reform. Some of these changes, of course, will not come that easily.
Our guest today is somebody who can shed quite a bit of light. Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber is a leader in initiating health reform in his state, which has made really significant strides in expanding health coverage for all of its citizens.
Margaret, Oregon has enacted some very innovative programs to ensure the state's residents have access to health care, and it could provide a great model for other states to follow.
Looking forward to hearing about that. And also, factcheck.org's Lori Robertson explores yet another health care claim from the campaign trail.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have a comment, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll get to Governor Kitzhaber in just a moment, but here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news. The Supreme Court decision upholding the legality of the Affordable Care Act hasn't stopped the political haggling. A GOP measure made it to the floor of the House of Representatives this week, attempting to repeal the act. The measure isn't expected to make it beyond the Democratic-controlled Senate. In the meantime, a Kaiser Health News poll shows a majority of Americans have moved on now that the measure's been upheld. 56% of those polled saying they don't want to see further efforts to overturn the law. However, if it were just among Republicans, almost 70% said they would like to see those efforts continue. One of the initiatives of the law, setting up accountable care organizations, or ACOs, is gaining steam. The Department of Health and Human Services announced the formation of 89 new ACOs, that is, groups of hospitals and medical practices teaming up to coordinate care and reduce costs. Those ACOs receive a share of almost $2 billion in federal funds. HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius saying better coordinated care is good for patients and saves money. Another measure of the law gaining some attention, mental health coverage. Nearly half of all Americans will have some sort of mental health crisis in their lifetime. The health care law will ensure that coverage for mental health issues, as well as substance abuse, is available to all those who need it. Currently, only a fraction of those suffering from such disorders are able to access such treatment via their health coverage. Global maternal mortality is still a big problem in developing countries, and it's the topic for discussion at a family planning conference getting underway in Britain. A recent study by Johns Hopkins University shows simply meeting contraception needs in the developing world could cut maternal deaths by a third. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news.
We're speaking today with Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber, a former emergency room doctor who is currently in his third term as governor. Governor Kitzhaber is a former director of the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, a longtime advocate for health reform. Governor also launched the Archimedes Movement in 2006, an organization seeking to maximize population health by creating a sustainable system using public resources to ensure everyone has access to effective health services. Governor, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, your state has recently awarded almost $2 billion grant from the federal government for an initiative to transform healthcare delivery, initially for the Medicaid population, but potentially as a model for healthcare reform across the country. And your plan is to use money to develop a coordinated care organization that you expect will save billions of dollars over the next decade. Now, you've been working closely with the Obama administration on this Medicaid experiment. Can you describe for us your vision for this coordinated care system and how it will improve access to care while at the same time reducing cost?
Well, you put your finger on it. This is sort of the vanguard of an effort to try to change the larger delivery system, but we're starting with the Medicaid population, 600,000 people. So essentially, the idea is to create coordinated care organizations around the state, and they will essentially put under one roof mental health, physical health, long-term care, dental health providers, those working in the community to try to address the underlying determinants of health, and create a new governance organization. They'll operate on a risk-adjusted fixed budget, and they will be required to create patient-centered care with medical homes, care integration. So the idea is to shift the organizational structure and the financial incentives from after-the-fact acute care to prevention, wellness, and the community-based management of chronic conditions. If this is successful, which we believe it is, will be, then we'll list this CCO as a coverage option on our health insurance exchange and try to move public school teachers and public employees in, and then after that open it up to hopefully small employers and eventually to Medicare.
So, Governor, we're so interested in this model of coordinated care, and one reason is it's something that garners bipartisan support, which not much does these days, from healthcare providers, insurers, unions, and politicians. And this plan is to connect the key providers, as you said, the medical providers, the mental health and substance abuse providers, oral health, to address this whole patient care. And it would seem that fundamental to this is going to be the need for these care partners to communicate electronically, certainly something both the Stimulus and the Affordable Care Act has been trying to do on the national level. Tell me, where do you derive your confidence that that big federal investment is going to result in even bigger savings? Are you modeling this after work that's been done other places, or is this really a kind of uniquely Oregonian solution?
Well, I'd say a little of both. We have one of the highest penetrations of electronic medical records already in our state, and we've created a health information exchange, which is up and running. And the idea is to allow coordinated care organizations not only to communicate with each other within their organization, but also between coordinated care organizations. So you could have somebody enrolled in the Portland CCO who happens to have a problem in Klamath Falls, and there would be a way to link that information electronically. So we're pretty far down the road on this, and I think it's really creating the financial incentives inside. So basically, HIT is part of the global budget, so there's a real incentive, since they're operating on a fixed budget, to improve information exchange so you can avoid redundancy in tests and can actually provide better continuity of care for the patient.
Governor, your state is obviously a leader in technology, and you've sort of outlined, you know, your work in electronic records, your health information exchanges. And I noted the other day you were at the opening of a really innovative video health clinic where patients will be able to tap into video doctor visits. But, you know, thinking about this model, really the practice of the future might be one-third by handling emails, one-third by Skype, and one-third office visits. Is that how you're envisioning it as well, the sort of technology as a decision-making tool helping the critical thinking that a provider has?
Exactly. So we have to change the fundamental business model of the healthcare delivery system, which now is built on the assumption that employers and the government are going to continue to fund an inflation rate 2 or 3 times the CPI. So that's one change. The other change is that I think we need to recognize that the old paradigm of getting care in a doctor's office is really outmoded. Today, if you need to go see the doctor, you have to call. First of all, maybe it's 2 weeks. Then you have to take time off work. Then you sit around for a while. And one of the reasons the minute clinics and these clinics in, Walmart have taken off is because of the convenience. So essentially what we've done is created a video clinic on the workplace. So if you have a problem, you can, you know, get in within 10 minutes on your break. There's a nurse practitioner on the other end that'll make a diagnosis and, you know, obviously within certain parameters, or decide that you need to go and be seen. But a whole lot of healthcare is minor problems, and this provides a wonderful venue to expand primary care without having to actually expand provider capacity.
So, Governor, one of the concerns that often comes up with providers when we look at reform is that, on the one hand, I think everybody wants to pay for value and not volume. We hear that a lot. And on the other hand, people are worried that they might lose out if they're working within a system of a lump sum payment. Tell me the degree to which payment reform factors into your innovation, and how is that being received by the provider community? What kind of innovation are you doing there?
Well, I think we need to compare it to the status quo. Providers are losing out right now on Medicare and Medicaid. And, you know, when the federal government raises the debt ceiling again in January, it's going to be very clear that it's Medicare and Medicaid driving the national debt. So we're looking at less reimbursement, not more. So what we've done with the risk-adjusted global budget is we've provided a stable revenue source that grows at a fixed rate so people, you know that it's going to grow. There are incentives inside that. So, for example, if a hospital and a physician group make an agreement that if they can reduce admission rates for congestive heart failure by X per thousand, the savings will be shared between the physician and the provider. Secondly, I'll just give you a great example. If you have a 90-year-old woman who lives alone with well-managed, stable congestive heart failure in an unair-conditioned apartment and there's a heat wave, and the ambient temperature goes up to, say, 102 degrees. That's enough strain on her heart to take her over in a full-blown CHF. Under the current system, you won't know about her until she shows up in the ED. Under this system, there'll be obviously an incentive to have community health workers checking on her on a regular basis to make sure she's okay. Under the current reimbursement system, under both Medicare and Medicaid, they'll pay the $50,000 for the hospitalization. They won't pay $200 for window air conditioner, which is all she needs to stay in her home and out of the medical system. So the difference there is $49,800, which could then be used to create some additional reimbursements for physicians and hospitals. And I want to just emphasize that these CCOs, while they do have a global budget, are required to be accountable for a host of metrics, including access, including clinical outcomes, and including patient safety and population health metrics.
We're speaking today with Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber, a former emergency room doctor, now third-term governor, who's been a longtime advocate for health care reform. Governor, you left medicine to enter politics, but you've made transforming health care policies a pillar of the work since you entered public life, and you fought for health rights early in your political career, co-authoring in the groundbreaking Oregon health plan, which passed in 93 while you were the president of the Oregon State Senate, which provided low-cost health coverage for working families, for those in need of insurance. And the program was an instant success. But today we're seeing so much resistance at the national level for the Affordable Care Act. What happened? Why is there such of a Herculean struggle?
Well, I mean, I think the United States Congress is utterly broken. I mean, the fact that in the Senate you need 60 votes to get a majority, it's bitterly partisan. And I think the fight about the Affordable Care Act is much more about the 2012 presidential election than it is about health care. And that ideology, unfortunately, has spilled out to state legislators who will vote against anything that looks remotely like the Affordable Care Act because they're somehow helping the president. And it's a tragedy, but it also tells us the mantle of leadership and action has been ceded to states and regions. In Oregon, we were successful. A, you need leadership who's willing to frame the health care issue not as a Republican or Democratic debate, but something that's important to families, businesses, and the state itself. And basically what we did is we framed it that way. We recognized it was a cost driver in the budget. We depoliticized it. And, you know, our health insurance exchange, as well as these bills passed up in some cases, 50-3 and, 26-7. I mean, huge bipartisan majorities. And I think it's just a comment on the fact that you've got to have a conversation based on interest rather than position. And, regardless of what the Supreme Court does, I think Oregon's work will continue to go forward because it's not contingent upon the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, we would lose out on the coverage expansions in that bill. But I don't have a lot of hope that the United States Congress is going to lead us forward on a lot of these very important domestic issues, from health care to education to transportation infrastructure.
Governor, speaking of conversations, Mark and I obviously have had the great pleasure of speaking with so many people who are providing great leadership in healthcare reform. And a number of themes begin to emerge as a consensus around quality and services and coverage, but also workforce. And one of the common themes that we hear over and over again when we speak about how to better coordinate care is the role of the community health worker. And yet, the community health worker, not a licensed group, not really well-defined training programs or degree programs, and yet absolutely vital as a link in keeping high-risk patients at home and avoiding those expensive rehospitalizations. Tell us about how you've approached that in Oregon.
Well, a couple of thoughts. First of all, the healthcare workforce has grown right through the recession, but unfortunately, it's grown by people running MRIs. And what we need to do is shift that workforce to something more productive that actually contributes to health. And that would be this community health worker who's charged with essentially managing chronic conditions in the community, providing that kind of assistance. We have a curriculum for a community health worker in our waiver request. We have our community colleges teed up to begin that curriculum. So we figure it's going to take a couple of years to build up a degree or certified health worker. That's essentially a key issue because, in many communities, hospitals are the biggest employers, hospitals and health systems. So you want to basically shift that workforce to doing this, something that's, more aligned with our health objectives. The other thing I think is important to recognize is that we, dealing with at-risk kids, these health workers essentially could do both of those functions. So the workforce element is critical. We have developed a curriculum, and we are going to, as part of our $1.9 billion, invest in the development of a new community-based workforce who that are trying to lead on this important issue.
And you've also been a leader in the Archimedes movement, which you founded in 2006, an organization that seeks to advance the fundamental triple aim goals of better health and better health care and reduce costs. And a key aspect of that is engaging people and empowering people, empowering patients. How are you engaging patients in this new system that you're rolling out?
Well, the Archimedes movement is a key element of it. We tried to do two things with the Archimedes movement. One was to change the frame. So instead of having this fight about universal coverage, which is really, you know, what the focus has been on for the last two or three decades, to essentially that the objective here isn't to finance medical care, it's to produce health. So if people can begin to understand that what we really want is to be healthy, then so changing that frame was point one. Point two is that 90% of what affects your lifetime health status has nothing to do with the formal medical system. It has to do with lifestyle, behavioral issues, socioeconomic issues, environmental issues, and people actually have the capacity to take steps to improve their own health and be empowered. So in our work, we have something called a health engagement model, which we're now applying to our public employees, for example, which they're required to take about a 6-minute health assessment online that gives them a breakdown of sort of where they are in terms of their cardiovascular status, weight status, et cetera, with a series of recommendations. If they don't take it, their copay goes up $30 a month. If they do take it, they actually get a benefit. So the whole idea here is to change the shift from coverage to health. So I would add also that there are health coaches that currently you can't get reimbursed for now. So for example, if you look at the people who come to the ER over and over and over again, many of them are people with an undiagnosed or untreated mental issue. And if you can intercede those people at the ER and hook them up with a primary care provider, you basically can give them the information they need or coach them on when they need to go in and when they don't need to go in. Dramatically improves their quality of life and health and dramatically reduces cost and overutilization in the ED. You know, the real tragedy is this became so polarized, and it became polarized primarily in the midterm elections, which is, again, all about the acquisition and retention of political power rather than the exercise of that power to do something meaningful for, you know, the citizens of our country. Because, you know, what the people who don't like the Affordable Care Act refuse to admit is that we already have a system of universal coverage. Mm-hmm. It's called the emergency room. And not even the most conservative teabag Republican would argue that if someone doesn't have health insurance, we should let them die in the ambulance ramp. So what we end up doing is financing strokes in the hospital rather than, you know, paying for blood pressure control in the community, which is not only fiscally irresponsible, I think it's morally irresponsible. So that is even a greater argument for states to stand up and be bold and courageous and honest and provide a beacon towards which we can take our country, because it is literally healthcare that is pushing us over the fiscal brinks towards, you know, the fate that's being faced by Greece and some of the other European countries right now. We don't need to go there.
Governor, often when we're interviewing new nurse practitioners for our residency program, it seems about half of them seem to have had some experience of working in ICU critical care or the emergency room, and they've been galvanized to become nurse practitioners and primary care providers by seeing the end result, the things that should not have happened but happened because all of the things we're talking about today. I wonder if you could share with us just a little bit of your personal story of that transition from emergency room physician to politics. Was that a galvanizing force for you, what you saw coming in day after day in the emergency room?
No, it became that. My political awakening came in 1968, particularly with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, whose campaign was really about equity and poverty. And I ran for the legislature in 1978, and my focus was on public education and the environment. I probably couldn't have told you in 1984 when I was elected to the Senate the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. As Senate President, I chaired something called the Emergency Board that has a little fund that keeps the budget balanced in between our biennial sessions. And our Medicaid budget was out of balance, and we balanced it in part by dropping 4,300 people off the medically needy program. And I remember thinking at the time, this was pretty easy. You know, we were sitting in this room in Salem, and we took a couple of votes and wrote some numbers on the paper, and miraculously we'd balance the budget, but we'd also just rationed 4,300 people from coverage. And I went back home and started practicing in the ED, and about 6 months later I started to see some of these people coming in who'd lost coverage because of this sort of actuarial decision we made in the state capitol. One was a guy who had a massive stroke because he could no longer access his blood pressure medication. And that was sort of an aha experience to me about the relationship between these decisions, these budget decisions we make, and the real human consequences. And so that's when I really began to try to think about how we create a more rational way to allocate the resources we have, which led to the Oregon Health Plan, you know, which really wasn't about controlling cost. It was about saying, look, if we only have X amount of money, let's not ration people. Let's keep everybody covered. And if we have to make cuts, let's remove those things that have the lowest value in terms of producing health. And so, I mean, I think my ability to navigate the healthcare world in a political environment is certainly enormously enhanced by my primary care experience, particularly in the ER.
Governor, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that our listeners at Conversation should be keeping an eye on?
Well, again, I think particularly states that have basically recognized that they're pretty much on their own. I would say states, and there's not a few of them, that recognize that Medicare is utterly unsustainable. And so I think places that are trying to change the frame of this debate to really look at it as it is, not like as the political system has made it, and have the courage to stand up and actually have that conversation with, and this includes end-of-life issues as well. I think that's what we're looking for.
We've been speaking today with Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber, a former emergency room physician and longtime health reform advocate who's transforming the delivery of health care in his state. Governor, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you very much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, as you know, there was big news about the federal healthcare law last week, with the Supreme Court upholding the law's constitutionality. And politicians, including President Barack Obama and presumptive GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney, quickly took to the airwaves after the ruling. Both made false claims. The president reiterated an old claim saying, quote, if you're one of the more than 250 million Americans who already have health insurance, you will keep your health insurance. But as we've said before, that's not a promise he can make. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has estimated that at least a few million Americans who get their coverage through work won't keep work-based plans. Some will do so of their own choice, getting coverage from another source. For others, employers may find it easier to send lower-wage employees to the state-based exchanges. Also, the president was talking about everyone with insurance, including those who now get their own coverage on the individual market. But some of those individuals may have to get a new insurance plan if theirs doesn't meet minimum benefit standards. On top of that, the president can't promise that employers won't switch insurance plans just as they could before the law was passed. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Millions of Americans living in poverty use the 211 InfoLine system to seek help for a variety of unmet needs, everything from childcare assistance to housing to food stamps. A new study shows 211, a nationally designated information and referral phone line for those in need, could also be a powerful tool in the fight to end ethnic disparities in cancer prevention and treatment. The study, conducted by Dr. Jason Purnell, a public health professor at Washington University in St. Louis, looked at 211 usage in four states. Callers, many of whom did not have health insurance and were more likely to be in need of primary care, were screened for their health needs. 70% of those callers were in need of at least one cancer prevention or screening service, and many of those callers needed two or more interventions. The study also found, since the callers in this population of racial and ethnic minority groups already had a high degree of trust in the 211 referral system, that they were more likely to accept cancer screening referrals for mammograms and pap smears and other basic interventions like smoking cessation programs. Purnell's study determined that with a targeted 211 messaging and outreach campaign, millions of Americans in the most at-risk groups could be effectively reached through the 211 system and referred to the prevention and screening programs best suited to their needs. The study determined that this approach could have a dramatic impact on reducing ethnic cancer disparities by directing an underserved population sooner to prevention and screening programs. Repurposing an existing information and referral system to direct at-risk and underserved populations to the interventions they need, improving cancer prevention and early detection, while greatly reducing disparities? Now that's a bright idea. is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.